We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Powered by Learfield. This is the Bobcat Insider, your exclusive look at Montana State athletics. Now, here's the voice of the Bobcats, Jay Sanderson.
Well, it's always an exciting time for Montana State athletics, but today we have some news to announce. The Bobcat Insider podcast is now available in some new ways. You can now download the program through the Apple iTunes Store. You can also get us on Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. It's totally free. All you have to do is search for Bobcat Insider podcast, set it up to subscribe, and the show will instantly download to your device so you'll have the most up-to-date content right at your fingertips the second it goes live. As we hit mid-May, graduation is behind us and most of the sports seasons have wrapped up. Track and field, it was announced today, got 10 into the NCAA West Regionals. We'll address that in a later podcast. But as we move into the off-season, we begin our new summer podcast series called Summer Conversations. And today we start with someone most Bobcat fans are quite familiar with. Dan Davies has been part of Montana State Athletics for better than 40 years. He played and coached football and has been an administrator ever since. Many Bobcat fans know him as the analyst on Bobcat football broadcast every Saturday in the fall. You can follow him on Twitter at DanDavies7684. So, Dan, how are you?
Doing great, Jay. I can't believe it's middle of May already. We were talking earlier before we got on the broadcast about how time has flown, and all we're waiting for now is some more consistent summer weather.
You're right, and get our golf games back into full swing. So as we begin here, we want to take a moment to remember a special man to Montana State football. Butte native Ron Euland passed away last Saturday at his home. He was a linebacker on the 1972 Big Sky Championship team, a two-time all-conference selection, and was described of playing linebacker as about as well as you'd want it played. We offer our deepest condolences to his family and friends. What are your memories of Ron Euland?
Well, obviously, he was a huge, huge part of Bobcat football. Particularly in the early 70s when he was recruited. Sonny Holland credits that recruiting success with Ron Euland to turn Bobcat football around. And he was a key recruit. Many great recruits followed him.
Including his brothers.
Including his twin brothers, Donnie and Danny. But that was a huge recruiting coup, and I remember listening to Sonny Holland make a presentation in front of the Hall of Fame committee about Ron to how important that recruiting success with Ron get the program, because it was a kind of a dark era there for Bobcat football in the early 70s when Sonny Holland took over, and that was, he gives credit to Ron Euland as part of that success.
So we send our condolences and best wishes to his family, certainly. Moving on for a moment, you're a native of Chinook. We actually stopped there for fuel last month on the Bobcat Club East Montana road trip. So I'm curious, when did you know that you were going to be a Bobcat?
Well, it goes back a long ways. Both my parents graduated from Montana State. And they actually met, my mom and dad actually met here at Montana State. My mom, interestingly enough, spent her first quarter at the University of Montana. And the reason she went there is that she had an aunt and uncle that were there, so she was able to live with them. But she, for whatever reason, decided to transfer to Bozeman. She grew up in Hardin. She was the valedictorian in Hardin, Montana. And whether that was being closer to home or whatever, but gosh, I wouldn't be here if that little move hadn't occurred.
Right.
And coincidentally, my wife is a graduate of the University of Montana as well. So there's some irony there, but with those two stories. But besides my parents, my oldest brother came to Montana State, and then my second oldest brother followed him as well, and they lived in Hedges South. I distinctly remember them telling the story that at one time there were three people that shared a room in Hedges South, which, Jay, I know you've probably been in those rooms, but that's hardly room enough for one.
Right.
And as much stuff as kids bring, we've helped in move-in day in August, about how much stuff, there's no way three people could have survived in Hedges in today's market, in what people bring to college every day.
Well, I just remember my roommate and I in college, when we got into our room, we're like, there are two of us going to be in this room for a full year.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine adding a third person in there. So that was at a different school, obviously. But the three men in a dorm room, that's probably not an easy feat.
So I have three older brothers, and the brother number three, the one that's just older than me, also attended Montana State, although we didn't finish here at Montana State. So the bloodlines go pretty deep here for me, and that's the reason I came to Montana State. I had a couple of opportunities athletically at some other smaller schools, but gosh, it was a hard tug to Bozeman for me to end up here.
Recruiting is the lifeblood of college athletics, and it has changed even in the last 10 years of how recruiting is, with the advent of social media and a lot of different things. What was your recruiting story like? I mean, you said the bloodlines ran pretty deep, so I imagine it wasn't a really tough sell for the football coaching staff to get you to Montana State, but what was the recruiting process like for you?
Well, that's an interesting deal, too. I wasn't heavily recruited, let's just say that. however, Sonny Lubick's wife grew up a block from my house.
Okay.
In Chinook. So oftentimes when Sonny Lubick was in town, so I've known Sonny Lubick a long time, and he was more than gracious to me, and cut me a lot of slack and showed me a lot of interest when he didn't have to, if I didn't live a block away from his in-laws. And also another brother, his brother-in-law, Pancho McMahon, is married to another sister of the Harbolts. So Chinook and Montana State were connected at that time, even though Pancho wasn't here then. He was an assistant at the University of Idaho, but ended up coming over here. But so I can remember Sonny Lubick sitting in my living room with my folks, and as gracious as he was then, and polite and professional, and all the things you hear about him was true in 1974 and five as well. So that was a huge thing for me. And I did talk to some other schools and so forth, and had some opportunities, like I said earlier, but that was essentially my recruiting process. I wasn't turning down a whole bunch of offers, believe me.
Your Twitter handle makes mention of a couple of pretty key years in Bobcat history. You were a player on the 76 National Championship football team and a coach on the 1984 National Championship team. How often do you just take a minute to reflect on how special it was to have been part of those two special seasons?
Well, Jay, at times I have to kind of shake my head and slap myself and said, did that really happen? And believe me, I want to be very clear, on the 76 team, I was a practice player and played on the freshman JV team. I wasn't taking any credit for any of the times on the varsity that time. But I will say I was involved in a lot of practices that involved the team, the players that played on that team. And I've got some bumps and bruises to prove that. But I take great pride in that, you know, be involved with a great bunch of people, a great, you know, great coaching staff, you know, Sonny Holland, Sonny Lubick, Don Christensen, Cliff Heisel, Howard Ross, those guys are being, and that was the coaching staff back then. There were five of them. And now you need a school bus to haul your coaching staff
right.
around.
Used to be 11 now.
Used to be a Volkswagen. Now it's a school bus. But, that's, again, and then the magic in 84 was unbelievable, a great group of individuals. And I want to pass some credit along to the Coach Lubick and his staff. They're the ones that recruited Joe Bignell, Mark Fellows, Lonnie Burt, Joe Roberts. Those types were the foundation of that 84 team. So that the credit's got to go to those guys too. And Coach Arnold points that out a lot too, you know, being the head coach of the 84 team. Another interesting little tidbit. Last week I got a package in the mail from Bill Diedrich, who was the offensive coordinator at that time. And he sent a nice note and three championship golf balls.
Wow.
To all the staff. And
that's pretty cool.
So there's another little reminder that just pops into your head unsolicited. And those are not going to get in my golf bag. I promise you that.
I wouldn't put those in play on a water hole.
They're not going to go in play everywhere. They're going on a shelf.
That's pretty neat.
So that's kind of a reflection on those 2 years. And gosh, you're right, Jay. How does that happen? And man, you talk about being in the right place at the right time and being extremely blessed to be a part of both those programs.
In what ways is winning a national championship different as a coach compared to being a player?
Yeah, there is a difference. Kind of a different reward system or different sense of satisfaction. You know, part of it's when you're a player, being part of the hard work and the camaraderie and the quote, to steal old quote, blood, sweat, and tears type deal. On the coaching side, it's more of a reward that, God, we got these guys lined up in the right spot and the right plays were called and they made the plays and Jay, at one point in the 84 season, we were 2-2. Mm-hmm. So that, after a 1-10 year in 83. So, man, there's two ways you can go, and by the grace of God, we were able to go up.
I mean, you mentioned when we were talking about Ron Euland that in the early 70s, there were some slim pickings for Bobcat football, and it slowly but surely got better until the 1976 championship. The 1984 season, remarable. 1-10, as you mentioned, in 1983. The 1985 season was a disaster also. But you opened 2-2 in 84, as you mentioned. Then you didn't lose again, roaring to the national championship with a win over Louisiana Tech. As that season was unfolding, I know it's 34 years ago, but as that season unfolded, how shocking was it to you and the coaching staff of what you were witnessing happening in front of you?
Well, I think, you know, the credit goes to Coach Arnold from the standpoint of he week in and week out, and years ago, the Bozeman Chronicle had a you pick 'em, you know, type deal like everybody had at that time. And the Chronicle would pick against us every week. And he would bring that up and say, hey, no one believes but you guys, you know, and you got to believe. And believe was the key word. And things that we, you know, stood on to motivate ourselves. And I always remember that. But after we played Idaho State, we were 2-2, and offensively we just played horribly. And sometimes you self-analyze, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And you overthink stuff. And I remember Bill Diedrich, our offensive coordinator at the time, decided that we weren't going to show the film to the players because he didn't feel it was going to be a good learning process. Well, and then we got on a roll, and we, from that time on, did not show we could show it to our position groups if we wanted to, but we didn't show the offense to the whole offense. And that was interesting. Now, whether it made a huge difference, I don't know. But the other thing I remember about the 84 team with Bill Diedrich as the offensive coordinator is that we would script our plays, and we did it Thursday mornings. We came in at 6 in the morning, scripted our plays, and the offensive staff went to breakfast. And that was another thing that would just – it became tradition, and not that coaches are superstitious or anything.
Right.
Kelly Bradley, he didn't wash his undershirt for the whole season after we started winning. So
man.
Anyway, but a magical season, no question about it. But to get back to your question, Jay, about when did you start believing, is that when you could just see the confidence growing. And, you know, it was a quadruple overtime with Reno here at the University of Nevada at Reno, at Reno H-Dale Stadium, which was a magical thing. And then beat Boise here on a knockdown dragout deal. And then we go to Fresno, and we're down 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. And they were Division I at that time, and come from behind. The Fresno coaches, coached by Jim Sweeney, former Bobcat head coach, they took their headsets off in the fourth quarter and thought they had it won. And there's a guy by the name of Joe Bignell that said, "We're not done." So it was that was a magical thing. And then to get a bye and to go on and host 2 games here, and then literally 1 day of practice for Louisiana Tech, and we're on the charter to Charleston, South Carolina. And you talk about scrambling, putting game plans together on very, very short notice. So
what was the difference, as far as you can tell, between 1983 when you go 1-10 and 1984 when you win it all?
Well, in 1983, we were pretty good on defense. We had and of course that was a core of the 84 team too. Those guys were all they were good. We had a good group there. We were struggling to find ourselves offensively. Of course, if you haven't got a quarterback in place that people can trust and believe in and that type of thing, it was really difficult. And we had some bad breaks, and we had some key injuries that everybody has, so that's not an excuse you can hang your hat on. But as well as things went in 84, they went equally as bad in 83 and in 85. You're probably going to ask me a question about the 85 thing probably too, but we lost Kelly Bradley, our quarterback at Northern Arizona, early in the season. And we were just not able to recover. In 85, we also had a first-team All-American tackle that did not return. And that's, as you know, how important that offensive line can be and how cohesive they can be. We just never recovered from that. That was another issue that we struggled with.
Now that you're an administrator, what drives you? What helps quench that competitive thirst?
Well, I'm involved in a way in all the sports at some point, so I kind of get to share in, you know, some of their successes as well when things go well. I still, you know, obviously enjoy Saturday football games, and it's hard not to get goosed up for that. Especially sitting next to you in the booth. And but it's I have the best of both worlds. I don't have the coaching hours that I used to have when I coach, but nonetheless I get to be involved and get to know these kids, and a little bit more about their background, and that's what's neat to see, where you see a kid come in and they don't know, you know, where the locker room is, and by the end of it, they're got their degree and they're got a job and making lots of money, so and successful. And the other thing that's the rewarding for me is so many of the kids that I was involved in the recruiting process live in town here, and I consider them good friends, and I get to see them, and some of them are doctors, and some of them are, you know, professional people that I rely on in my personal life. So that's real rewarding too.
You've worn a lot of different hats around here. As I look around your office, Big Sky Conference Golf Championship trophy sits over there on your shelf. You've been the golf coach, the women's golf coach here. You've done a lot of different things. How many different roles have you held since you stopped coaching?
Well, when I started in administration nearly 30 years ago, 30 years ago this fall, there was a men's athletic department, a women's athletic department, and a field house operations. In 1993, those three entities merged. Women's athletics, Jenny Hunt, the athletic director that got this women's program going back in the day, retired, and the university decided to merge those things. And also in 1993, we added two sports, skiing and women's golf. So I took over as fieldhouse operations, as well as assistant athletic director and women's golf coach. So as a steal a phrase from Dale Kennedy, I was busier than a one-legged guy in a butt-kicking contest. but enjoyed every minute. The only regret I've got is you know, my kids were young then, and I didn't get to, you know, enjoy a lot of those things. And I give my wife Jen a huge amount of credit for handling that part for me, and she did a great job. But so that's started out just in men's athletics, and then we merged, and we've been one department since, and then. A few years after that, the field house broke off, and it's the way it is now as sports facilities, which is a real plus for our athletic department that they are able to manage our facilities for us.
What are your roles now on a day-to-day basis? You're the director of internal operations for the athletic department. What all does that entail?
Well, primarily game management and facilities. I'm involved in the process of getting our facilities upgraded and with our athletics facilities capital campaign that's underway right now, involved in that process. I was involved in the strategic planning process that we just went through a year ago. I also currently, and interestingly enough, all the sports that we've got, I've managed or supervised at one time or another. which just kind of gives you an indication how long I've been here. But currently I oversee or supervise the weight room, our men's and women's skiing program, our women's golf program, and our track and field program. So I've got a good chunk of at least the and if you're just looking at numbers of athletes that I've got. But I've also in the past had the equipment room. I've also had the training room, and like I said, a variety of other. At one point, I was also the interim compliance director. So
wow.
I've had a good taste of a lot of it. I can't say that I'm great at all, but I know a little bit about everything.
One of the roles, as we've mentioned, I've had the great honor and pleasure of working with you the past four seasons on the Bobcat football broadcast. How has your view of football and just the game itself changed with your perspective over these last many years as a broadcaster?
Well, it's like, I almost have to describe what a huddle is in this day and age, because
right.
No one uses it anymore. I mean, people just walk around and they know what they're doing.
Right.
And people understand that used to be a process. In fact, I don't know how many teams huddle anymore.
Even in the Big Sky alone,
yeah.
I can think of maybe two.
Yeah. And
us in North Dakota, and we don't do it all that often.
No. And it's kind of like they turn around and look at each other, and that's what a huddle is. It used
right.
to be a big formal process. You used to practice it in practice. All right, this is what a huddle is going to look like. We've got to look sharp. We've got to break. We've got to sprint the line of scrimmage. But that doesn't – I mean, so that's one of the biggest differences. But I think the schemes are complicated, and I'd be lying to you say if I totally understood them all, but yet they're still pretty darn simple on what things to do. I mean, even if you talk about, you know, the running game, the zone, inside zone, and stretch and those things. I mean, those are pretty basic. I mean, you said, all right, running back, the guy does this, you do this. I mean, that's pretty simple. Passing game, go around, quick slant, and the quarterback will throw it to you. That's pretty simple. But when you're looking at the scheme of things on what a quarterback has to look at and make decisions as he receives the ball, shotgun, not much under center anymore.
Right.
There's a decision process that's got to occur instantly, and it's got to be naturally too. You can see, you know more than anything, Jay, in terms of when you see a quarterback mechanical and they're just boom, boom, they're just struggling. Mm-hmm. That it just doesn't look comfortable at all to them.
Right.
And there's other ones that looks like, man, they just got it.
Right.
And that's a big difference that I've noticed recently.
I think also the speed of the game, in just in terms of the offensive coordinators, or many of them, are now in the frame of mind where they want to have as little time as possible between end of play and the next snap. And we saw that here when Tim Kramsey was the offensive coordinator, and the Big Sky in at large is kind of that way also. I mean, there are teams that want to snap at 90 or 100 times a game, and that is just marvelous. When you compare football even to 15 or 20 years ago, when it was the 40-second play clock and they're milking it for everything they've got, and you know, the game is just so much faster now, and there are so many more snaps, and everybody talks about the high-scoring nature and the up-tempo football. I just think it's the number of snaps they play, and it requires the players to be in a better physical condition.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I can remember we used to have when I was coaching, we used to have a goal board, and the defense had their goals, and we had art on a weekly basis, and I believe one of our goals at that time was to get 90 snaps. I mean, that means you don't have many three and outs,
right?
When you're, you know, on the offensive side of the football. So I remember that distinctly. Remember, it was 80 plays, and that seemed like a lot to get to. It's more common now. It's not really a huge goal to get to now for some teams. They can really do that. Because they don't take any time to huddle and they want to run plays. Now, you know, as a defense, it's a strain for them, obviously, because they can't substitute personnel and guys get tired. And if you don't get a three and out, man, it's a strain on those big guys.
I want to kind of shift gears and I want to talk to you about another legend in Montana State athletics history. Sonny Holland was a center and a linebacker on the 1956 National Championship team. He was the head coach of the 76 team that you played for. You've known Sonny for a long time. He has a statue in front of the stadium. He's had just about everything in this town, or at least on this campus, named for him. We know the mark he's left on Bobcat football, but what impression did Coach Holland leave on you personally?
Yeah, that's a easy question and a hard question, or a complicated question. And I think I've mentioned this before in some of our discussions, but when Sonny talked to the team in the locker room or on the field, practice field, or in the game field or whatever, there was not anybody that wasn't paying attention and listening and engaged to him. He had that magic quality about him, and that's true of a lot of leaders. But man, that I've never experienced any before him or after him that had the ability to engage people. And even after that, he was done coaching and he was the alumni director here for many years, as well. And of course he's a great ambassador for Bobcat athletics and football and specifically, but, he's still a renowned guy and a guy that people, whether they're former players or fans or boosters, he is so engaging and people want to hear him talk, and because the message he's got is always special. And I just want to reflect a little bit about Sonny Holland. He was an All-American as a freshman on that 56 team. Think about it, Jay, as a center, how do those guys get recognized? I mean, literally, there's no stats. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. That is a phenomenal accomplishment for him to get noticed as a freshman at center in 1 year throughout that season. And you just don't see that. There's not many four-time All-Americans anywhere, let alone in the offensive line. It takes a while for them to establish themselves, but he got people's attention right away.
You mentioned the presence he was able to have and command a room. What was he like as a coach, though, playing for him day to day?
Well, at part of the time, he was just the head coach. And the other part of the time, he helped with the outside linebackers. And, you know, head coaches like to be head coaches, but they like to coach, too. They like to, you know, and you look at Coach Choate.
Very hands-on, yes.
He is in the drills, and he...
Which is what you want. I mean, it lends more buy-in as a player.
No question. That's exactly right, Jay. That is a buy-in deal. And so I know you really, Coach Holland really enjoyed doing that. I know Coach Choate does too. But because you can be a guy, you're not the head coach. You're just a guy. Mm-hmm. And there's something to be said about that. But the assistant coaches really respected him too. When he talked to, but he let his guys coach too. I mean, he wasn't one of those guys that, hey, you need to do this, you need to do that. Because I've been around guys that have done that too. That say, and everybody's uptight. The players are uptight. The assistant coaches are uptight. But he let his guys coach, and he was able to trust. He hired good coaches, and he's able to trust them. So he's that's a good quality as a head coach as well.
You have a favorite Sonny Holland story from when you played, or in the years since that you've gotten to know him over the years?
Yeah,
I'm sure there are plenty.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I'm just trying to think that one that sticks out more than the other ones. But you know, whenever we go to Butte or do Butte functions or whatever, I mean, it's just amazing. Not only just Butte, but Butte's special in that regard. When he comes home, and he talks about the Butte Hall of Fame, and talks about our Hall of Fame, but the Butte Hall of Fame, and he is revered over there. Just like he is here.
Who's more famous in Butte, Sonny Holland or Evel Knievel?
You know what? That's a good comparison. They are both unique in their own ways and have their own special qualities. There's no doubt about it. But that's a good matchup. That would be a good poll to take.
You've been part, as we've mentioned, of the Montana State community for quite a while, and Bozeman as well. How has this town and this campus changed in the years that you've been here?
Wow. Man, that's I tell the story here that we were in a meeting the other day and talking about the campus in general, and you may not be aware of that, but obviously this was the edge of town here on campus. But one of the stories I remember hearing is that when the Fieldhouse opened in 1957, it was built in 56, and I think the first event was here in 57, it was in the winter. And I hear Hayden Ferguson's the one that told me this story, is that, I mean, it was a big deal when this building got opened or built and opened. And so they had a big fancy event, and I think I'm pretty sure it was a basketball game, but it was going to be a, you know, people dress up and make it a big to do. And of course, the middle of winter is in January, and the there was a Chinook wind that came in, you know, a warm wind, and it just, and there was not a chunk of sidewalk within 200 feet of this place, so the parking lot was dirt, gravel, or whatever, and people were all dressed up, and they had nice clothes on. And I remember Hayden Ferguson distinctly remember him saying that people were walking out of their like overshoes and stuff, and it was just a mess. And of course, once you got in here, it was muddy and everything here too. But you have this nice, and you got formals and dresses, and they're all muddy. I guess it was a fiasco. But the other thing is that I was in a meeting the other day, and I was when I was in school here, the area, the mall in front of the library in Montana Hall, you could drive. That was a street that was open.
Really?
So you think about that.
Wow.
About that. And then the other story, I wasn't here when it happened, although the fall of 1975 when I got to town, McDonald's just opened here. But when the high school was built on Main Street there, that would have been in the 60s. I'm not exactly sure, but that was the edge of town.
Really?
That was the edge of town. It was a gravel road went east there. So
it has exploded.
Oh,
I mean, it is. I mean, it's essentially now just town all the way out to Four Corners and Belgrade, getting closer to that.
Well, and the amazing thing is to me is that Belgrade is going to go to a AA school next year. So in 2019. Mm-hmm. So it's the only school in history of Montana that went from Class C, eight-man football, to a AA school.
Right.
And, of course, a testament to what Bozeman's doing is that in 2020, they're opening their second high school.
Right.
So there's going to be there's one AA high school in the Valley right now. Pretty soon there's going to be three. That's amazing to me.
That is remarkable. It's exploded. I mean, there are surveys and studies done that say this is the fastest growing area in the country. And I mean, Bozeman, it's become an urban area in many respects.
And there will be people that would debate you that that's not a good thing.
Right. I know I've been here at Montana State, as we mentioned earlier, just 4 years. You can add a zero to that. And I know how fired up I get on game day when Montana State plays Montana. It's just a different vibe. And particularly when we played the games at home, to see the stands fill up, it gives me chills, and the hair on the back of my neck stands up. And one of my favorite parts of this job is how special and important that day is. It's one day. It's one game out of the entire year, but it means so much. It is as intense a spectacle as anything I've ever encountered in sports. And at the heart of it all, it's a day for the fans to team with their Bobcat pride. So, I've seen and I've heard, I mean, not to throw you under the bus here, but there have been a couple of times these last 2 years when the Bobcats have beaten the Grizzlies in football, there have been a play or two where I've caught your voice crack a moment on the air. I remember distinctly a play where Mac Bignell got a fourth down stop last year to get a turnover on downs, and both of us were like sucking it back a little bit because of what Mac and the Bignell family means around here. So if you can, put into words what Montana State University and Bobcat Athletics has meant to you and your life and for your family.
Well, it goes back to earlier comments about my parents, going to school here. And the other interesting thing, and I didn't realize this here till a few years ago, but putting two and two together, when the Student Union was built, my dad was going to school here. And if you walk in the front side, from the north, those mm-hmm. steps, they're indented.
Right.
So he had a part in that, of creating that dent, the very first part. And I didn't think about that here for the longest time. I started putting the years together, and I said, that's pretty special.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Dan, we appreciate your time very, very much. This has been fun. We'll have to do this again sometime because I'm sure there are many, many more stories you could share with us about Bobcat Athletics in Montana State and the city of Bozeman. Again, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, now available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Also, stay engaged and interactive with us. You can follow Dan on Twitter at DanDavies7684. You can follow me on Twitter at MSU Bobcats Voice. I'm Jay Sanderson. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Bobcat Insider. Be sure to stay up to date with all things Montana State Athletics by visiting msubobcats.com and by following the Cats on social media on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle MSUBobcats. The preceding has been a Learfield presentation.